Namo Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Gurule Srimade Bhakta Vedanta Swami Niti Namane Namaste Sarasvata Deva Gauravani Pracharane Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschata Desha Tarane Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Shiva Siddhi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama 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 Hare 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 Dānena pālayan uvīm prajā sīlena aranjayan vārtamāna samā sveshu sreya kīrtim avapsyasi Dānena pālayan uvīm Prajasilena Ranjayan Vartamana Samasveshu Sreya Kirtim Avapsyasi Dharmena Palayan Urvim Prajasilena Ranjayan Vartamana Samasveshu Shreya Kirtam Avapsyasi Palayam, protecting Murvim, the earth, Praja, the citizens, Silena, by good character, Aranjayan, delighting, Vartamana, remaining. Sama, equally disposed, Sveshu, to your relatives, Shreya, perfection, Kirtim, glory, Avapsisi, you will achieve. Translation, by religiously protecting the earth, delighting your subjects with your noble character, and treating all your relatives equally, you will surely achieve success and glory. Purport Akura told Dhritarasa that even though he had usurped the throne, if he now ruled according to the principles of Dharma and behaved properly, he could be successful. Text 19. If you act otherwise, however, people will condemn you in this world, and in the next life you will enter the darkness of hell. Remain equally disposed, therefore, towards Pandu's sons and your own. Purport Dhritarashtra's whole problem was his excessive attachment to his nasty sons. That was the fatal flaw that caused his downfall. There was no lack of good advice from all sides, and Dhritarashtra even admitted that the advice was sound, but he could not follow it. One can have clear practical intelligence when the mind and heart are pure. Translation, by religiously protecting the earth, delighting your subjects with your noble character, and treating all your relatives equally, you will achieve success and glory. This is Akura's advice to Dhritarashtra. And as the purport mentions, Dhritarashtra had plenty of good advice, but he could not take that good advice. Even though he was conversant with the rules of Dharma, and in some senses he acted properly, and Vidura as well was constantly giving him advice, he did not take that advice. He had great intelligence, but nevertheless he did not take that advice. So what was the advice? That is summarized here by Akura, and he says that you should have good character, and you should treat your subjects, and particularly your relatives, the Pandavas, equally and without prejudice. Even if you are ruling as the king and you're not giving them the throne, you should in no way put them in danger. And of course, the reason for putting them in danger was that in this way his own sons could assume the throne. So this is a problem of attachment. When we have great material attachments, then we do not listen to intelligence, we do not listen to scripture, we do not listen to good advice from others. That attachment may blind us to the common sense or whatever. Now, this is a problem we often experience in the material world. This was Dhritarashtra's problem also. So what is the cause of it? The cause, of course, is that though the intelligence is there and we have logical abilities in our brain, in our intelligence, still the attachment and the desire to get some sort of enjoyment is so strong that we do not listen to that intelligence. Just as, for instance, in the airport they have these signs when they're coming through the sales area where they're trying to sell you tax-free goods. All the liquors and cigarettes and stuff, and you get a nice little, you know, little reduction in the price, and they sell you more things there. So they have the cigarettes there, and above the cigarettes it says "smoking kills," big letters, just above all the cigarettes. And people are going there buying all the cigarettes. And of course, on the box also, I think the cigarettes, it says this is induced to your health or whatever. And even in India, they have the same type of thing you have to put on your cigarette box, you know, the companies have to do that. But still they're making profit and people are buying like anything. Good advice is there, and even compulsory advice is there in many cases. Legally you have to do certain things, but because of people's attachments, they don't listen to that good advice. And so this is a problem in the material world. It's not only Dhritarashtra's problem, it's the problem of every human being. And we may have good advice, or we may see things, and we still don't listen to the truth. We don't see the truth, actually. We don't take it to heart. So, in other words, a real intelligent person will learn simply by getting good advice. And perhaps he will see it in life. He will see some incidences, and he will learn from that. But the unintelligent person has to learn by experience only. And what is that experience? You suffer. And when you suffer, then you may change, or you may not change, even with the suffering. So the one that does not change, even with the suffering, then he is the most unintelligent of all. One who suffers and then changes, then he's got little intelligence. This is the problem in the material world. People don't really change in spite of all the problems they come up with. That is actually the rule of karma. Why do people suffer in this material world? Because they did previous sinful activities. Why do we have the law of karma? So that you will learn, don't do the sinful activity. But in spite of getting the suffering, people still commit the same sinful activity. And they go through the same experience of suffering again and again and again. And they go on in the material world like this for great periods of time, and they never correct themselves. So we say that there's anadi karma, karma with no beginning, which means birth after birth after birth, for billions and billions of years we've been going through karma, which means that we didn't correct ourselves properly, and therefore we continue. And you can continue forever if you want to. So this is the situation of some living entities. In spite of all the experiences and many, many births, they will continue to act in the same way and get the same sort of punishments again in terms of karma. Which means pretty unintelligent. Now, of course, we can raise the argument, well, people don't remember their past lives, so how do we expect them to correct themselves? That's somewhat of a good argument, we could say. But we can see the same principle operating within one lifetime. Huh? The person commits the same mistake again and again and again and again, and he gets the same punishment, and still doesn't correct himself. Of course, the criminals are common for doing that. They do the crime, they go in jail, they come out, they do another crime, they go back in jail. But even in normal life, people follow the same sort of habits. They make the same mistake once, and then they get some sort of bad reaction for that. Then again, they do the same mistake again and again and again and again. For instance, people get married, they get divorced, and they get married and divorced, and married and divorced, and married and divorced, and they may go on for 3 or 4 or 5 or even 11 times. And each one ends in divorce. They didn't learn once. They go through 11 cycles of this and still there, suffering. So therefore, the ability to learn is there in the living entities, but it's a very slow process for many, many human beings. Very, very slow. And sometimes there's no learning process at all. They just simply go through the same thing again and again and again. So that is why we're in the material world so long. Sometimes people say, why are we in the world so long? Why does Krishna have to give us endless births in this material world? Why? Because we don't learn. We don't learn from those experiences. We don't correct ourselves. So it is not only Dhritarashtra's fault, but it is a common fault of everyone in this material world that we have our attachments, and these attachments will override any intelligence we may have, or shastra, or good advice, examples, visible examples before us. We don't listen to that, and still we go on and pursue our attachments. In the case of Dhritarashtra, of course, his attachment was his sons. This is a great attachment for him. Perhaps in the modern world we won't have such great attachment to the children as they did in those times, but particularly for the kings or the kshatriyas, they did have great attraction and attachment for their sons, because the sons would inherit their kingdom or their properties and their position, etc. So they wanted their own family to become the heirs to their property and their power. So therefore they very attached to their children, particularly the sons. So for this reason, Dhritarashtra couldn't see what was wrong with his sons. They were actually criminal, because they were trying to always harass and kill the Pandavas. But Dhritarashtra would not see that. And of course he was blind, but he would hear the advice from his counselors and Vidura and others, but he wouldn't listen to that. So this was because of that great attachment. We should not think, however, this is so unusual. We'll see this throughout history in India and other countries of the world. This attachment to their own family members over others is very strong, very, very strong. And, of course, we see it in the politics today. The Nehru family continues in India as a governing body of the governors of the country. So this idea of attachment to family is very, very strong. Of course, we have attachments to many things in this material world, but for many people, the attachment to family is the strongest attachment. Wife to husband, husband to wife, husband and wife to children, children to parents, etc. This very, very strong type of attachment, more than an attachment to the money and the car and the house, etc. Usually it's the attachment to the people involved, which is stronger than anything. In this way, these relationships, which are supposed to give rise to some sort of rasa and some sort of bliss in the material world, with that expectation, we have all this attachment. And therefore, they can lead to a lot of problems, these attachments. And that is why, within the scriptures, we will have strict rules of conduct for everybody in the Varna Ashram system, so that the attachment doesn't become too great. Now, of course, that's become a little bit of a distortion in the modern world, but nevertheless, in the Varna Ashram system, there were strict rules for conduct within the Varna Ashram system, and that is why the parents had to send their children to the Gurukul so they wouldn't become too attached to them. But then the children had to learn about spiritual life and renunciation and detachment and tapasya and, you know, higher knowledge, mukti, liberation from the material world, etc. Then they would come back to the house and most of them would get married. So then there's, again, a scope for attachment, because you get married and you have your house and your family and whatever. However, because they had the early education of tapasya and detachment in the Gurukul, then they would have an idea of not being too attached, hopefully, because of that life in the Gurukul. And because of their separation from their parents, then they would also have some detachment from parents. They wouldn't be so attached. So this was some sort of guarantee that the household wouldn't fall too much into Maya. Of course, we see here it didn't happen. In the case of Dhritarashtra, he was very attached to his children, etc. And we see throughout the castes, of course, the attachments are greatest in the Sudras, little less in the Vaishyas, little less in the Kshatriyas, and most attachment in the Brahmins, because they're more sattvic. So at least the Brahmins and the Kshatriyas should have some sort of detachment. And that is very necessary, because the Brahmin is striving for liberation from the material world. He has to be detached. The Kshatriya is heading for a brahminical life, and he is to rule the kingdom. And to rule the kingdom, he cannot show prejudice. He has to be very detached also. He cannot simply favor his family members over the rest of the citizens and, you know, exploit everybody for his own advantage. He has to have some sort of detachment. So in the Varnashram system, the rules for the Brahmins are the most, and the rules for the Kshatriyas is also quite heavy. Particularly for the Kshatriyas, because the Kshatriyas have power. And if power is not combined with principles, then it becomes very, very dangerous. So therefore, you have to have a lot of control, sense control there in the Kshatriya position. So it says in the Smriti Shastras that, you know, the king, if he is attached to hunting or to intoxication and such things, he's not qualified to be a king. If he's addicted to gambling, he's not a king. You cannot have all these strong attachments who are corrupting influences upon him. And he has to rule with justice. And justice, the sense of justice is strongly emphasized in the Smriti Shastras. And in order to do that, have that justice and be sama, as it says here, you have to have some sort of detachment from life. Yeah? You may know the principles, but if you aren't a little detached, then you won't apply the principles when it comes to the certain situations. You will show your prejudices. So this is a problem, actually. That goes very deep in all of the living entities and in the human being. It becomes obvious in certain situations. So the Varna Ashram tries to restrict that by the rules. As we know, rules are good, but attachments are stronger. So this is a constant problem. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur has explained that the Varna Ashram imposes the rules. Follow this, and of course, according to your qualities of Sattva, Raja, Tamadhi, you have different sets of rules to follow. Nevertheless, it's somewhat of an imposed system of morality and conduct. And because it's imposed, therefore, it is not a real guarantee of anything. So he says the opposite system is that we perform bhakti. And when we perform bhakti, we are cultivating not the mind and the intelligence and things like that. We're actually cultivating the soul. Now the soul also has qualities and its own morality and its own principles. So we see, for instance, in Krishna, he has 64 wonderful qualities in perfection. So the soul is not without qualities. Wonderful qualities. Just as Krishna has 64 wonderful qualities, the jiva can have 50. So we can also, to some degree, we can develop these qualities, not as much as Krishna, but we can also manifest these qualities in the soul. But they won't develop unless we do bhakti. If we go for jnana, we will develop one quality, sama. Everything is equal. That one quality. Only one quality will develop. Everything is one. if we develop our bhakti, the atma then develops all wonderful qualities, just like Krishna has so many wonderful qualities. These are some of the aspects of the soul. So in the devotional service, we say that the first quality is kleshagni, the second quality is subhada. And one of the meanings of subhada is that we get sadguna, we get good qualities, endowment of good qualities. So Bhagavatam says that, you know, one who's practices devotional service has all the good qualities which are available in the devas or whatever, and that if you don't practice a devotional service, then nothing is there. What is it? Nothing. No quality. So, of course, the qualities in the devatas also, because they are material, is sattva gun qualities. But the devotees in the devotees cultivate bhakti. Those qualities are not material at all because they're coming from the atma. They're spiritual qualities. So if we develop the spiritual qualities, they become permanent. They're not temporary. And therefore, this is a solid basis for performing one's actions in the material world. If we have eternal qualities rather than temporary qualities which will change according to our self-interest, then we have a better basis for acting in this material world. So the reason that the qualities are all, the spiritual qualities are better is the fact that it is all based upon a relationship with the Supreme Lord. The Atma's relation with Krishna is the basis of all these wonderful qualities. And what is the basis of that relationship? Unconditional surrender. No self-interest at all. We have no interest for ourselves. So there's no conflict because all these qualities develop as a matter of our complete surrender with no self-interest. In the material world, we have a conflict between what are supposed to be wonderful qualities like honesty and non-violence, etc. And then we have our actual attachments to the material world for our own purposes. So the ideal qualities of morality are there to make us detached. At the same time, we are very attached to fulfilling our material desires. So ultimately, our material desires win out over our sense of morality. And then we'll ignore those moral principles and instead we will indulge in our sense gratification. Because we have these strong desires held in the mind, etc. And the intelligence is of no use. Whereas, if we don't have any desires and we have only desire to serve the Supreme Lord, then there's no self-interest at all. So therefore, there's no challenge from any of these material things for the devotee of the Lord. He's interested only in Krishna. So therefore, when the Pandavas ruled, their only interest was Krishna. And they had no self-interest. They weren't really attached to the throne at all. They didn't really want it. But Krishna said, no, you must take it for the sense of dharma in this material world. We have to kill all the demons and establish the devotees. So you'll play the role of the devotee and you must take the kingdom. So therefore they accepted the kingdom. But they had none of the, they weren't selfish in the sense that Dhritarashtra was selfish. That I want it because these are my sons. So they did it just as the, because they wanted to please the Supreme Lord. That's all. So there was no conflict for them at all. And then they ruled the kingdom very, very peacefully, in a good manner, according to Dharma, etc. So therefore, if one, if we develop our bhakti, then naturally all the good qualities should follow with a solid basis upon the Atma and upon surrender to the Lord. So that is why in devotional service we say that cultivation of good qualities is not an anga of bhakti, as what Rupa Goswami says. This is so we don't separately try to cultivate all good qualities or even sattva or whatever. They are actually the automatic result of bhakti. So we're not trying to cultivate sattva gun or whatever. That's also material. We're trying to cultivate relationship with Krishna. Then, of course, sattvic things will manifest. And, of course, sattvic habits are also conducive to bhakti. So those rules and regulations which are conducive to bhakti, those we will accept. And those which are not conducive, we avoid. So that's why we have regulative principles. Because breaking those principles is not conducive to bhakti. So in this way, we accept things which are conducive and reject things. But we don't have some sort of separate cultivation beyond our bhakti. Bhakti is the main principle. And everything else follows from that. So that is the system. So that is why in the Bhagavatam, we will, and even Bhagavad Gita, for instance, at the end of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, Sarva Dharman Parityaja, Mamekam Sharanam Braja. So what is this Sarva Dharman? That's all dharmas, even Varnashram Dharma. Give it up. After telling Arjuna, you must fight, you must follow your dharma as a kshatriya and all this in chapter 2 and 3, encouraging him to be a king, etc. And then at the end of the Bhagavad Gita, just give it all up, forget it. Simply surrender unto me, only bhakti. And in Bhagavatam again we'll see. Yes, it talks about Varnashram system, it talks about so many things. At the same time then it says all this cheating dharma, Kaitava dharma. Project that we reject all this cheating dharma. That is because if it becomes the predominating factor in our life, then that is not the principle. The principle is bhakti. And we can accept Varnashram dharma or gyan or anything if it is non-contradictory to bhakti and favorable. Then we can accept it. But if it becomes prominent and bhakti is a minor factor, that we're not interested in. The whole purpose of Bhagavatam is to say bhakti is the major principle and other things, don't get distracted and think that other things are going to get you the final result. That is cheating. And so that is what Vasudeva had done in the Tamagun Puranas and the Rajagun Puranas. He had encouraged people to worship different devatas and to follow our Varnashram system. Gradually they become detached from the results of their work by rising up to Sattva-gun. Then they can take to the worship of Vishnu very nicely, and then they can become Vaishnavas. Then they can advance. So it's a good principle. But finally, even Vedavyas understood this is not actually proper. And therefore, after writing all the Puranas, then he was feeling some restlessness in his heart, discontent. And that is why Narada Muni came to Vyasadeva and said, I know the reason. Because he actually he compromised everything by talking about Varnashram and worship of devatas and worship of Shiva and Brahma and Agni and whatever in the different Puranas. And this is, people will do this. And they will do it. And then they will become very attached to that. And because it's Kali Yuga, they won't even advance beyond that. They'll get stuck on this one level, the lowest, Karma Yoga. And they won't go beyond that. So this is not practical for us in Kali Yuga. So therefore you reject everything and tell them this is do bhakti. So therefore he wrote the Srimad Bhagavatam, Amala Purana, and beyond Sattva Gun also, to advise everyone bhakti is the main principle. If you want to do other things, do it, but secondarily only, and as supporting bhakti. So this is the principle. So we will see, as I said in here, that we'll see Varnashram, disgust, etc. If we look in the 11th canto, also there's a big discussion of Varnashram system and Jnana and Yoga. They're all discussed. But if we look carefully also, we'll see there's a whole analysis of the gunas and what is beyond the gunas. So then it talks about these different things being in the gunas. And Jnana is also only in the gunas. Jnana is sattva, ultimately. Karma is rajagun. So what is beyond the gunas is bhakti. So he classifies so many things, and each time bhakti is beyond the gunas, holy dhammas, holy tirthas are beyond the gunas. Devotional devotees are beyond the gunas. They're beyond the gunas. Everything else is in the gunas. So in this way he shows the superiority of bhakti and Supreme Lord and the devotees. So therefore, everything has to be secondary to the principle of surrender to the Supreme Lord. Things helpful to that we accept, things which are not helpful we will reject in whatever system, whatever rules they are. By doing so, we fulfill the objects of all the other processes. So whatever you achieve by karma yoga in terms of good qualities and morality and sense control and peace of mind and prosperity and whatever, you get that also by bhakti. And whatever you achieve by jnana in the sense of sama, being sama to everything and getting destroying all your karmas and getting out of the material world, you also get that by bhakti. So whatever you can achieve by karma, jnana, yoga or other processes, you will achieve by bhakti as well. So as Bhagavatam says in the first canto, by bhakti you get jnana vairagya automatically. Whatever knowledge you achieve by and detachment you get by the process of jnana, you can get that in bhakti also. So this is the principle that is followed in the Bhagavatam. So obviously we understand here that Dhritarashtra wasn't a devotee because his principles were completely distorted by his attachment to his sons. He was very attached to them. Pandavas, they were completely detached from everything in the material world, only attached to Krishna. And therefore, they could act properly. He could not act properly. So that is the principle that we follow. Of course, the way that Akura argues here again is like Krishna arguing in the Bhagavad Gita to Arjuna in the second chapter, where it tells him you should fight because it is glorious and you don't get defamed and you get a nice kingdom, and next lifetime you also get a nice kingdom. These are all material reasons for fighting the battle. So here, Akura is saying the same thing. Oh, you will also get success and glory by acting in a nice, just way. But this is a material reward or whatever he's trying to tempt him with so that he will act in a proper way. Anyway, it is very difficult for such people who have material attachments to listen to good advice. Because ultimately their own sense of enjoyment overrides every other principle. And this is the problem. It's not only for Dhritarashtra, but everybody in the material world. Okay, any questions?
Yep. Can I ask is, do you consider that bhakti is a quality of the soul? And do we regard love and compassion as a similar quality to bhakti?
Love and compassion meaning for other living entities?
Yes.
Oh, well, actually, they're considered important qualities because in the second quality of bhakti, subhada, there's a different, what does subhada mean, and then there's different definitions. One, I said sadguna, you get all good qualities. But before that it says that one becomes dear to all living entities and all living entities become dear to that devotee. In other words, all the living entities respect that devotee and one shows dearness to everybody by showing kindness and affection for all living entities. And then a commentary, I think, of Jiva is that, well, these are also qualities, so why we put them separately from the other qualities, like, you know, honesty, etc., sadguna. So he says, because they're very important qualities, they're separated out. So therefore, the idea of being compassionate to all living entities is, you know, a very important quality among all the shadgunas, or wonderful qualities that a devotee will manifest. Yeah? And we'll see that mentioned also in the Bhagavad Gita in so many places, and I think in the fifth chapter and whatever, that the person who becomes sama, then he is equipoised to all living entities, and he doesn't harm any living entities. So yes, that compassion is there. At the same time, it should not be based upon material motives or self-interest. And that's a problem in the material world, that a lot of our compassion is kind of a basis of self-interest. So it is very difficult for us to separate, you know, causeless compassion from motivated compassion. So if we have that natural compassion, which is a reflection of Krishna's mercy, because Krishna is the most compassionate. Krishna wants to save all the fallen souls. Lord Chaitanya wants to save all the fallen souls. So also the devotees want to save all the fallen souls and help all the fallen souls. So it is naturally there. In fact, that is Krishna's greatest quality, his merciful nature, the Supreme Lord quality. So similarly, the devotees will show that. They'll be most merciful also. But it may differ a little from the compassion shown in the material world. So we see that the compassion in the material world is we help suffering people, whatever, you know, poor people and starving people and sick people, whatever, and that's what we call compassion. And the devotees may not do that, and be like the great saints are off in the forest or something chanting or whatever. They're not helping people, running around doing social work. So they say, oh, they're not compassionate. So the compassion will be shown in different ways. So for the devotee, he understands that the root of the suffering of living entities is their ignorance, and therefore he tries to deliver them by taking them out of ignorance. And he said that's the only solution. All the other things are like temporary shows of compassion, and they ultimately get covered up again. So unless we remove the ignorance, nothing will happen. At the same time, it doesn't mean that we just look on helplessly while everybody suffers in the material world. We can't do that either. So we do that, but at the same time, we have to have that understanding that behind this, we have to remove the suffering of the living entities.
The gopis were saying how they were the only ones who were able to completely give up their family to follow Krishna. And the monkeys of Vrindavan, I've been told, were unable to give up their material attachments, and therefore they still had a strong attachment to Krishna, and therefore they were born in the Dharma, and therefore they'll die in the Dharma, get liberated at that point. So is it that some jivas are just not able to give up material attachments?
Material attachment is very strong, but if one develops an attachment for Krishna, then ultimately we can give that up. So the whole process of bhakti is gradually, by increasing our attachment to Krishna, we give up our material attachments. So we don't bar prema from anyone. We've got prema, that means no material attachment. And every stage before that, there's more and more and more and more and more material attachment until you get to the materialist, who's 100% material attachment. So therefore, we do not bar anyone from the process of bhakti or prema. But those who have committed offense, serious offense, it's very difficult for them to practice bhakti at all, even if we give it to them. And we expose them to it. It takes a long time for them to get any effect from that bhakti. Other persons who are just neutral, you expose them to bhakti and keep doing that, then eventually they will develop an inclination that can begin to develop. And that means gradually their material attachments will disappear. Those who are offensive, then it's kind of hopeless. Or a very, very long time it takes.
What's the relationship between Vidura and
Vidura?
Family
relationship? Is there one? Vidura, no. Because Vidura was came out of the the brothers of brother of Dhritarashtra and Pandu. Yeah, through Vyasadeva. No? And Akura, his father, what is it? Swafalka? Yeah, as his father, whatever. That's that lineage. It's a different lineage. I think Vasudeva only gave birth to those three, yeah?
Something that always intrigues me is the fact that Gandhari is always exalted as a very chaste wife, rich person. Yet, he wasn't really worthy.
Yeah.
And that is always used as a model for women to aspire to. Uh-huh. It seems like he's sacrificing a higher principle for a lower principle.
Yeah. Yeah. She was exalted because she was attached to her husband. Her husband was a big demon. So why be attached to a demon? So, of course, in sometimes we glorify the one principle. So in this sense, we glorify the devotion to the husband, because she was very devoted in spite of everything, and then she covered her eyes and like he was blind, etc. So that part's the good part. The bad part, of course, is that he was a big demon. Why should she be devoted to a big demon? So there's a little conflict there. She chose to do that rather than reject him. Yeah, for the Vaishnavas, real Vaishnavas, then in that case, they can give up. If the husband is a big demon, they can give him up. And they get no censure or criticism for that, as Vaishnavas. As part of the Varnashram system, I suppose, this was the principle, they wouldn't give up. But as far as Vaishnava is concerned, if there's a big demon, better not associate with them anymore. Yeah? So that's the Vaishnava principle, which is higher. So we get two sets of principles in the Mahabharata. The Varnashramic principles are glorified like that. But of course, then we have the level of bhakti, which is higher.
So then the other one is Draupadi, Kunti Devi, and
Yeah.
Could I make a comment or a slash question about that point that you raised?
Yeah.
And that is that there's sort of a case in currently before the law that has been a criminal who's obviously still got family members who have regard and love for him. And it seems to me that this sort of bit like you're sort of horrified when that happened about someone who's so evil, obviously. It just seems to me that one of the things that it demonstrates is that Krishna even has compassion for the fallen, and that people can, you know, he's got to reach out to the fallen as well. The fallen are still available for Krishna's compassion. And that's one of the things that demonstrates that relationship that you asked about, is compassion for the fallen, that they can still be worthy of someone.
Well, of course, that's there. That Krishna does that. He's capable of doing that, and he does that because he even liberates these worst demons who attack him, and then he puts them in the spiritual world, and they become great devotees. He does that, and Lord Chaitanya does the same thing with Jagai and Madai, even though they attack Nityananda. No? And for the devotees also, of course, Lord Chaitanya is playing like a devotee, so therefore the devotees also have to act in the same way and see the good and the bad people and try to, you know, elevate them or whatever. So that's also there. If we take that as Gandhari's motive, then it's very, very good. She's there and she wants to try to purify her husband. It's good. That's also a good motive in that sense. We never hear of Gandhari actually supporting his bad activities or anything like that. But of course, for most people, it's very difficult. Huh? If the husband is so evil, and then the wife is chaste and following him, then it's very likely she may get influenced by him also. So that's a problem for us. For us, anyway.
And just on that sort of same note, another comment as well, on the cursing of Krishna towards the end, so we just like...
Why curse God, yeah? Well, yeah, I guess you could say that. Maybe it's an attachment to her own children or whatever like that. So that's, again, a family attachment, a show of fault, you can say, a family attachment.
What was the curse that she...
What's that? That's a good opportunity for him to leave the earth. That's a method for him to leave the planet. This is described again in, I think, the second canto is the whole description of his plan to leave the planet and how he did it.
It's interesting because Vishnu Dev is considered to be a great way to learn, yet he fought.
Wrong side.
So Gandhari externally may have appeared as associated with the demons, but at the same token. Facilitated Krishna's plan, and he got happy with that.
Yeah.
And so in that sense, even activities which appear to be inimical to Krishna, but because they're pleasing to Krishna, it's actually considered a devotional service.
If they're part of his lila and they are devotees, then yeah, they play that role.
So we have to be careful about
condemning the demons.
Externally it might appear, but internally we understand. Actually her cursing facilitates his pastime, so actually he's pleased by that.
That is so. I mean, it says it quite explicitly in the world that that is the secondary benefit that Krishna gives. But again, if one is talking about Gandhari and the mentality of attachments, what is the comment to that?
Well, if she's there to display qualities of dharma and her place as the wife, then of course she is ideal in that sense of being, following him and sacrificing her eyes or whatever for him and whatever, in that sense, good. Yeah.
And even Krishna demonstrated the fault of that with Yudhisthira's behavior. Just being dharmic.
Yeah, true. And then he had to break that.
Just being dharmic is not the be all and end all.
The highest is to surrender to Krishna's will, which is higher than dharma.
Yeah.
And therefore, the people that attack because why did Krishna do this or why did he do that, Krishna makes the dharma and he can break it if he wants to. It is only, these are principles we follow in the material world. The system of dharma actually is material. It's a system for Raja, Tama, and Sattva. And the rules are there for gradually raising people up to Sattva Gun. And it's all material world. The spiritual world is different. And therefore, Krishna, if he wants, he can ignore all the rules and do whatever he wants because he's beyond the rules anyway. And if he does it, there's no fault because it's spiritual. His intention is spiritual. So if he wants the Pandavas to win, let them win by any means, even if it's against the so-called Dharma. Dharma is there for the material world, but actually the higher principle is bhakti. Where favorable we accept, if it's conflict, then we don't have to follow.
Then you have a corruption of that in that, the devotees decide, well, we're serving Krishna, so we don't
you break
have
all
to follow
the
Dharma.
This
fellow has a demon.
So that, of course, maybe we say it's called premature. If one is a pure devotee, then of course he has all the wonderful qualities naturally within him. And again, if we just use that excuse to to manifest our own rajagun or tamagun or whatever, then this is a big problem again. So we can't confuse the two things, the real qualities from the artificial qualities.
That's one reason why we still have to adhere to the dharma. Because it's supportive of bhakti.
Yeah. To the extent that we are still in the material world, attached to the material world, to that extent we follow the rules of our natural.
But when it becomes an obstacle to bhakti,
then we can. And of course, Krishna says, I also follow the rules of dharma in the material world as much as possible to set a good example for other people so they become purified. But again, he can reject them when he wants to.
Requires a little bit of intelligence out of the bodies.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.